Our speaker for tonight, Donald Hay. He's an emeritus fellow in economics at Jesus College. And we'll be speaking on God, government, and economic justice.
Well, I'm very grateful to Carl for inviting me to do this evening, because it made me sit down and actually think about things which I hadn't really thought through properly before. So there's a benefit. My title is God, Government and Economic Justice. I realised as I was going through the material this afternoon that actually I'm going to say very little about government, and that's largely because I think it would have been just too long. So we may want to pick up the questions about government a bit later on in the questions. So without more ado, let's push on. What's motivated this talk? Well, it's partly the fact that over the last sort of 15 years or so, quite a number of Christian advocacy groups have tended to use material from the Old Testament to as part of their campaigns. So, for example, I don't know if any of you know about it, there's the Jubilee 2000 campaign, which was for international debt forgiveness, and it made an explicit appeal to the concept of the Jubilee in Leviticus 25, picking up some of the provisions there for the cancellation of debts. And then last year there was this group called Micah Challenge, which was actually focused on action to meet the Millennium Development Goals. And its focus was on the famous words from Micah 6:8. Let me remind you of them. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And so it was called the Micah Challenge. And it was, I think, quite a successful thing. Now, quite apart from those sort of headline things, I suppose we've all heard sermons where the speaker has appealed to the principle that God is a God of justice to address issues of perceived injustice in our world. So I've heard over the last couple of years references, for example, to God as a God of justice, talking about people who don't have the basic means of life, food, clothing and housing, both internationally and nationally, or the victims of war and civil war, or refugees and immigrants, or the sexual exploitation of women and children. So there's very often an appeal to the God of justice. And let me say immediately, I have no objections to what these people are trying to do, all right? I have no objections to, as it were, what's the purpose. My problem arises that I have some concerns about the way in which the Old Testament is being used. And I think, let me just sort of explain briefly why I have concerns. The biblical Jubilee, Leviticus 25, presupposes a very particular agrarian economy. Notably, a pattern of landholding, which was unlike anything in the ancient Near East at the time that it held, in the second half of the second millennium BC. Now, those who used it in, say, the Jubilee 2000 campaign, they simply said, all we're doing is we're abstracting this idea of debt forgiveness from the Bible and from the text. The problem is, if you do that, you're in danger of actually losing the context in which it occurs in Leviticus 25 and elsewhere. It's much more than just debt forgiveness, and as we will actually see in a minute. And the other thing which strikes you immediately, if you go to a concordance and you look up references to justice, what you find is very frequently justice and righteousness are linked together. And that suggests that there is a an overarching concept of justice and righteousness, or righteousness and justice, and it's quite complex. It's not entirely straightforward. And in particular, I don't think it's necessarily captured by our contemporary understandings of justice. So what I want to do this evening is, first of all, I want to explore what justice and righteousness meant to the biblical writers. And then secondly, I want to look at two dimensions of economic justice in the Old Testament economy. One was really the rules which ensured that families had the means to sustain themselves, and then secondly, provision for the poor. So we'll come to that in more detail. But what I want to do in each of these cases, looking at the Old Testament texts, is to identify the underlying principles in these two dimensions of economic justice that Christians might usefully employ in contemporary discussion of economic issues. Now, this third element is absolutely critical, because unless we can do it, that is, unless we can derive some sorts of principles, what this talk becomes is a critical analysis of the implications of various Old Testament texts for the economy of ancient Israel. And then the question is, well, why has that got any relevance to 21st century economic thinking? And this, in a sense, is the core of the method which I'm using, and you may wish to challenge it. My first point is simply this. The biblical pattern has God not only creating the world, but ordering it. And that human communities are ordered by God's purposes for humankind. And so, there are moral requirements for how we should live together in community. There are moral requirements. So I'm going beyond the standard creation story to talk about human communities being ordered or governed by God's purposes for humankind. My next point is that what underlies the detailed prescriptions for social and economic life of the people of God in the biblical materials, what underlies it, are precisely those principles for they're examples of God's moral ordering of communities. And if you think about it, what's happening is the Old Testament economy, and actually, of course, the New Testament church, are kind of exemplars of the ways in which God's desire to order human communities work out in particular situations. So what we have to do is we have to do a very careful analysis of these examples to identify the principles of God's moral ordering of society and economy. Now, these principles then can then, with caution and accepting their provisionality, be deployed to provide a specifically Christian understanding of the contemporary economy. But to do that, to apply them, we also need to have a very good understanding of the way in which the contemporary economy functions before we can apply the principles. So just note two implications of what I'm saying. The first implication is that the logic of this approach emphasizes there's no shortcut from the biblical text to contemporary economic problems. It's going to need a lot of hard work at exegesis and analysis. And that's the point at which, in my view, pronouncements by preachers and church leaders tends to be misdirected or completely inadequate. Okay. So I think that we have to go into things in much more carefully. And the second is point is that I don't really think it's right for Christians to use slogans which have been lifted from the biblical text without, I think, a proper understanding of what those New Testament, Old Testament words mean. So I think I'm right to be uneasy about Micah challenge. I'm right to be uneasy about Jubilee 2000, because I think it's, in a sense, sloganizing. And
I mean, that's a bit pejorative. I don't mean it in a pejorative sense. But it's taking biblical concepts and it's actually using them completely out of context. And I don't think you can do that. Okay. So let me just explain what I'm proposing to do. The next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to explore what justice and righteousness meant to the biblical writers. I'll then go on to two dimensions of economic justice in the Old Testament economy. So let's go to justice and righteousness, or righteousness and justice. And the first thing I want to draw your attention to is that righteousness and justice in the Old Testament are integral to the character of God. Let me remind you of the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32, 3 and 4. It says the following. This is part of the Song of Moses at the end of Deuteronomy. I will proclaim the name of the Lord. O praise the greatness of our God. He is the rock. His works are perfect, and all his ways are just. A faithful God, who does no wrong, upright and just is he. Yeah, word for upright there is the same Hebrew word as the one for righteousness. Or in Psalm 97, verses 1 and 2, the Lord reigns, righteousness and justice are the foundations of his throne. Now the important point here is that righteousness and justice come out of the character of God and are integral to who he is. I think on the basis of those texts which we've looked at, we can say two things. The first is, we can say another thing, and that is that God's rule of his world, as I've suggested before, is principled. In other words, that there is a structure to it. It's not capricious. He is the rock, and he can be relied upon to exercise his authority consistently and faithfully. So let's go dig a little bit further and look at this first word, righteousness. Now, the Hebrew root is S-D-Q, and you can fit in what vowels you want into that. But the point about the righteousness word is that it has two dimensions biblically. And the first one is the relationship that God wills human beings to have with him through faith. Love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. The other dimension is the relationship with the neighbor, the other human beings. And that implies loving and willing obedience to the norms or principles of conduct in interpersonal relationships that God sets and commands. And those are summed up, of course, in the injunction to love your neighbor as yourself. So righteousness, the understanding of righteousness, it's a set of norms or principles. Now let's ask about the next one, justice, or mishpat. And that's a slightly different word. It's the appropriate treatment, especially of human beings in a relational setting, according to the norms or principles of conduct commanded and set out by God in each particular case. That is, these justice is the actions that should follow from righteousness. The interesting thing is that justice is commanded as something to be done. In other words, treating people in the ways that God requires. And often in the Old Testament, the idea of justice is actually putting right something which has gone wrong relationally. So it's an action which puts right something which hasn't worked. Now, you may find all this a little bit abstract, particularly if you're not Old Testament scholars. Let me try and give you an illustration. Suppose you own something that I really need to use. For example, a book for the purposes of constructing this talk. Now, righteousness is the norm that requires you to lend it to me, and importantly, requires me to return it to you. So those are the norms. The norms are, if I'm your brother, you should lend me the book because I need it. And secondly, after I've finished with it, the norm requires me to hand it back. So justice is the actions which correspond to those norms or principles. So you lend, I return. Of course, if I fail to return, you could very well send one of your friends to find me and to take the book from me. And again, that would be doing justice because I had failed to act justly in returning the book to you. Do you get the distinction? Is that all right? Do people understand that? I mean, it is the distinction between a set of norms which describe what conduct should be like, and then the actual operation of those in practice. Now, what I want to suggest to you, or show you, is that righteousness and justice are required by God of humanity. So in Ezekiel 18, the prophet gives a word picture of a righteous man. That's one who does what is right and just. He is faithful to the Lord, he shuns idolatrous practices, and he is commended for his just actions. He does not commit a robbery, but gives food to the hungry and provides clothing for the naked. In other words, that's what a righteous man is. He's one who does right and just because he's got a right relationship with his neighbour. Generally, unfortunately, the verdict of the Old Testament prophets is a denouncing of the failures of Israel to pursue righteousness and justice. So Amos 5:7, you turn justice into bitterness and cast righteousness to the ground. And it goes on in that passage to list evils and lack of justice that characterized Israel in the 8th century BC. But righteousness and justice are also required of rulers, and this is the only place where I'm really going to talk about government. So in 2 Samuel 8, verse 15, which I haven't got on the notes there, David is commended. David reigned over Israel, doing what was right and just for his people. But sadly, generally, the focus is on the failure of the kings of Israel and Judah to fulfill their calling. So Isaiah 10 verses 1 and 2, woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people. So the rulers are required to make laws that promote righteousness and justice and to punish those whose attitudes and conduct fall short. So that's, in a sense, the methodology stuff. What I now want to do is to take two key areas of Old Testament teaching, one on economic justice and one on caring for the poor. So let's go on to economic justice. And the first thing I just want to point out is that the main focus of complaints about injustice in the Old Testament is economic, nearly always. What they're referring to is some kind of economic injustice, particularly the infringement of land rights and the treatment of the poor. But there is a problem, and that's a problem that I've already alluded to. Most people presume that the Israelite economy of 3,000 years ago, approximately 3,000 years ago, is completely irrelevant what we do today. And that, I think, is the reason why, on the whole, you very seldom hear a sermon which actually addresses detailed material in the law, because it seemed to be kind of irrelevant in some way. But I want to argue it's not irrelevant because, and this is my point, the specific arrangements for land in Israel reflect God's moral ordering of his world. So we need to go behind the particulars of the geography, the culture, and the historical context to discern those principles at play, to work out what they are. That is, the principles are, in a sense, the righteousness, the ordering of our world that corresponds to God's purpose for it. And in Leviticus 25, there are three key elements. The first one is the land is God's gift, and I'm afraid there's a typo there. It ought to be Leviticus 25:23. The two are slipped out. I'm sorry about that. And the whole point of that verse, God says, the land is mine, but in the context, he has given it to the people of Israel. The land is God's gift. And you will know that that picks up the themes of Genesis 1 and 2, where the human race is given dominion over the natural order. And in Genesis 2:15, the man is placed in the garden to work it and keep it. And that is a prominent theme of the whole of Deuteronomy. Now let's move on to the second thing. There's a question about, well, how was the land allocated among the families? And this is actually spelled out in Numbers 26, a chapter which I suspect most people jump over if they're reading through the Old Testament. The context is the children of Israel are in the wilderness en route for the land that has been promised. And God instructs Moses to take a census. And much of the chapter, chapter 26, is a report of the numbers enumerated by tribes and families. So why a census? Well, let me read this to you from towards the end of the chapter. The Lord said to Moses, the land is to be allocated to them as an inheritance based on the number of names. To a larger group, give a larger inheritance, and to a smaller group, a smaller one. Each is to receive its inheritance according to the number of those listed. Be sure that the land is distributed by lot. What each group inherits will be according to the names of the ancestral tribe. In other words, the land allocations were exactly proportionate to the numbers in each group. When you turn over to Joshua 13-19, which is another much neglected part of the Old Testament, what you find is there's an account of the implementation of these instructions in the actual geographical allocation of land. And there's an additional twist there, which is really interesting, that the land holdings are adjusted for the quality of the land. So what's lying behind this, the implication is that there is equality in the allocations and that every Israelite family is allocated the means to support themselves. Every Israelite family is allocated the means to support themselves. But then what happens if a family loses its land? Well, Leviticus 25 does not explain why a family might lose its land, but you can just imagine an agricultural economy. It could be mismanagement, it could be crop failure, it could be debt. Those are the obvious candidates. And the long-term solution is, of course, the Jubilee year, every 50 years. So Leviticus 25:13, in the year of Jubilee, everyone is to return to his own property. So there could be no accumulation of land. In the short term, 50 years is a long time horizon. Remember that the life expectancy at the time of Israel going into the Promised Land was almost certainly less than 40. All right, so 50 years is sort of the grandchildren we're talking about. So there are other provisions in Leviticus 25. The seller, should he have the resources to do it, has the right to buy back the land if he's actually sold it to somebody else. Equally, if one of his relatives comes along with enough money, they have the right to buy back the land. And if all else fails, then the person who's lost their land must be given work to do as a hired worker, not as a slave, and that until they can get their land back. Now, it seems to me that there are some really interesting principles implied here for economic justice. And let's work through these. And as I go through them, I'm going to kind of comment on how they might be applied even now. So the first one is, under the Old Testament system, every individual or household has access to opportunities to work to provide for themselves and their families. So the question is, well, what's the equivalent to that in a modern economy? Now, it may be, of course, access to some kinds of physical capital, so physical resources to work with, an office with IT, or hospital with equipment, or a business with machinery and equipment. But I think perhaps more important is actually education, skills, and experience. And maybe one of the things we need to pick up from here is that if every individual or household has to have access to opportunities to work, then one way in which we could, as it would, carry that into a modern economy is to ensure that everyone has the education, the skills, and can accumulate the experience that they need. Now, the second point is, because the land was allocated relative to the number of people in it, the implication is that with appropriate effort and application, the workers could support themselves and their families. There's a huge problem which faces the advanced economies in the West at the moment, but particularly the UK and the United States. And that is that you have people who are working full-time, you have households where both the man and the woman are working full-time, and they can't earn enough to make ends meet. That happens particularly in the big cities. So there's a huge problem in London, where you have people who are doing what seem to be quite significant service jobs in the service economy. They can't make enough money to pay the rent, to buy food, to buy clothes, to care for their children, and so on, although they are working pretty well full time. So the question then is, well, how in a modern economy are you going to meet this requirement that with appropriate effort and application, workers can support themselves and their families? And there are some interesting things being suggested. One possibility is that you set a minimum wage. And one of the things which has been pushed for is that the minimum wage should actually be set as a living wage. I don't know if you've come across this in Oxford, have you? There's been quite a campaign to get the colleges to pay a living wage. That is, a wage which will enable someone who is working full time to be able to afford to live in Oxford in reasonable, not in comfort, but in, they can actually survive here. So you could have that. In the UK, I don't know about other economies, for a long time we've had something which is called income support benefits. That is, where somebody is in work but is not making enough money, they can get some kind of further income supplement paid to them in order to bring their income up to a minimum level. But in the long term, actually, it all goes back to this first point about opportunities to work. What we need to do, we need to address education, because that's the key. And what we have is better educational opportunities and motivation, because the more skilled people are, the more they're actually going to earn. And then finally, this idea about equality and access to resources and the whole Jubilee thing. Clearly what's happening in the Jubilee is that periodically, every 50 years, everything is kind of taken back to square one as far as the land allocations are concerned. And that, of course, redresses the inequalities that arise over time. Now, clearly, there's no obvious parallel to that in a modern market economy. But we do have an inheritance tax. And one of the things which you could think about is you could say, why don't we make sure that inheritance tax really works? I don't know what it's like in other jurisdictions, but in the UK, if you're clever, you can avoid, even if you're very rich, you can avoid a lot of inheritance tax. Why don't we make sure that inheritance tax really works? Why is that important? Well, because what it would mean is, it wouldn't be the case that every year, every time it moves between generations, that people just simply inherit a lot of wealth from their parents, which they have not, of course, done anything to get. So you might say, well, the great objection to inheritance tax is that governments waste it. Well, here's a suggestion, or two suggestions. One is, instead of the inheritance tax being paid to the government, why doesn't it get paid into what many rich oil countries have, which is a sovereign wealth fund? Okay? So you pay it into a sovereign wealth fund. The sovereign wealth fund then generates an income stream, and this could be used to support low-income families, to provide education or improve the educational system, and so on. So you could have, as it were, outside government, you could have a system of a sovereign wealth fund operating. The other possibility, and I think this is quite important, it does happen to a degree, is that you can avoid inheritance tax here if you give all your money to a charity. And maybe that's what we should be encouraging more people to do. So we can say to them, well, if you don't like giving, or if you don't want to leave, I don't know, 50% of your net wealth to the government, you could just arrange to pay it to a charity, any charity you like. Because that would actually generate an enormous income stream for charities. And it would actually mean that you get much more kind of social buy-in. Okay, what I hope I'm trying to show you is, first of all, as far as the Jubilee stuff is concerned, or the land stuff is concerned, we can derive principles from what looks like a very archaic system. We can pull things out, and suddenly you begin to think about them in the context of the modern economy, and they begin to make quite a lot of sense. Okay. Let's now move to justice for the poor in the Old Testament. Now, there's a very interesting fact, which is that where poverty and the poor are referred to in the Old Testament, it's nearly always linked to oppression. It's nearly always linked to somebody's land being taken from them, or their crops, or their livestock, or to oppressive taxation to finance a ruler's palaces, courts, and military adventures. The only place where poverty is directly linked to laziness is in Proverbs. Everywhere else, all the prophetic denunciations, they all link it to oppression. Now, as far as dealing with poverty is concerned, the main barrier against poverty is what we've just gone through. That is, each family had their own land, but it would, of course, be a serious problem if a person had no land. So who didn't have any land? Well, the answer is two groups: those who had had to sell their land until the Jubilee, and secondly, those who have no inheritance, the foreigners or those without families. And for these groups, there were three provisions to address the problems which arose. And again, these look like very specific to a rather kind of ancient economy, but I think we can make quite a lot from them. Let me begin first of all with the triennial tithe. Let me read this to you if I can lay my hands on it. Where have we got? Triennial tithe, Deuteronomy. Oh yes, okay, it's Deuteronomy 14, towards the end of the chapter. At the end of every 3 years, bring all the tithes of that year's produce and store it in your towns, so that the Levites, who have no land allotted to them or any inheritance of their own, and the foreigners, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied, and so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the works of your hands. There's a bit of discussion among the scholars as to whether the triennial tithe was an additional one, or whether it was just in place of this, or it was just the standard tithe. Most people think it was an additional to the standard tithe, which of course supported the temple and the sacrifices. Now the interesting thing about the triennial tithe is it was a simple welfare system. Store it in your towns, they said. Okay, store the triennial tithe in your towns. I presume that it wasn't the same third year for everybody, you know what I mean? So otherwise they would have a lot in one year and then nothing coming into the stores in the next 2 years. But I don't know how that worked. And they are to provide for the foreigners, fatherless, and widows locally. Now let's go for another area, which is Deuteronomy 24:19, and here we're talking about what are called the gleaning laws. And again, let me read this passage to you. When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. Then goes on to say, do the same with the olives in your trees, and do the same with the grapes in your vineyard. Leave what remains for the foreigner, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. That is why I command you to do this. Note, this is not a handout. The poor had to go into the fields and the olive trees and the vineyards to gather what had been left for them. And then thirdly, this question of interest-free loans, and where we're back to Leviticus 25. This was probably, I think, to deal with one-off events such as a crop failure or a family illness. And it was a form of mutual insurance. The loans were to be generous and without onerous conditions. Moreover, there is pre-provision for cancellation of such debts every 7 years to prevent accumulation of indebtedness. Let me read again from Deuteronomy, where a lot of this material appears. So this is Deuteronomy 15. And the first few verses. At the end of every 7 years, you must cancel debts. This is how it is to be done. Every creditor shall cancel any loan they have made to a fellow Israelite. They shall not require payment from anyone among their own people, because the Lord's time for cancelling debts has been proclaimed. And again, mysteriously, the writer goes on to say, however, there need be no poor people among you, for in the land the Lord your God has given you to possess as your inheritance, he will richly bless you. So, what's going on here? Well, what I think the writer is saying is God has blessed the land so that there is abundance. So if one person's crops fail, there should be, other people should be able to come in and help them out and give them a loan to keep the thing going. So there's an implication of reciprocity. I have a bad time, you lend to me so I can buy food and so on. Next year you have a bad time, same bug comes and eats your crops, I look after you. So the implication is that the loans should be repaid if the circumstance of the brother recovers. So what principles lie behind this? Well, firstly, I just want to say under the sources of poverty, I just want to say poverty seems to be a feature of life in communities, and it has multiple causes. So what does righteousness require? What are the norms that underlines God's moral ordering as human societies in this area? And the first thing, I think, is there is this systems of mutual support, the triennial tithe, the gleaning laws. Note that these are systemic. This is not private charity. Private charity is not enough. The welfare state was present in ancient Israel, which may come as something of a surprise to you. Secondly, the expectation
is that a poor person should be able to recover economically, and then a loan on generous terms is appropriate, but debts should not be allowed to accumulate. We have a very serious debt problem in this country, a huge debt problem. We can talk about it, the details later on. But the fact is we have a system, or we've developed a system in this country, where it's clear that people are having to borrow in order to meet what we would regard as kind of the standard necessities of life. So we have a serious problem. And here, the expectation is that debt should not be allowed to accumulate. Notice, interestingly, that this system, these systems, this sort of embryo welfare state, all the systems were local. Why is that important? Well, it minimizes the problem of what economists call moral hazard. That is, you need to be able to distinguish between the genuine poor and those who want their effectlessness, their effectless behavior subsidized. And then I'm not going to look at it tonight, but there's this really interesting passage in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 where Paul is encouraging the Corinthian church to make their contributions to the church in Judea, which was going through a very hard time, almost certainly because of famine or crop failure in Judea. And he says the criterion should be equality. The criterion should be equality. That's for another talk. So let me, as it were, conclude. Basically, what I hope I've shown you is, first of all, that this idea of righteousness and justice, they together, that reflects God's moral ordering of his world. And the way in which we have to understand it is, I think that righteousness is the norms or the principles that should govern our relationships and community. And justice is the actions that flow from that. So you could have the principles in one sense, but to do justice may mean very different things in different contexts. Okay? But they're both important. It's the righteousness, the norms, the principles that, as it were, stimulates the actions that correspond to these norms, depending on the particular situation. What I hope I've succeeded in doing is uncovering the principles behind the Old Testament requirements for ancient Israel. And I think if there are two things which really come out of this, is that righteousness and justice in contemporary life should be focusing on equal opportunities, equal economic opportunities. And that's a big question, exactly how you do it. And secondly, on generous support for the poor. And so what we need to do as Christians is to think about what's an appropriate framework for addressing these issues in our contemporary society. Okay. I'm very happy to take any questions.
Would you like me to field questions? Or
why don't you?
Yeah, sure. Yes.
I think I'll just get myself a glass of water.
Sure.
Okay, so.
Should we start a queue?
My view is you can pick up many of these same themes in the New Testament, but I just wanted to try and get across the idea
the ideas, and I thought I'd keep it within kind of reasonable bounds. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you can do the same thing in the New Testament. I think in some ways the New Testament is not as helpful, because the Old Testament material is very much that of a community which had a kind of identifiable economy and so on. But, for example, concern for the poor, that's very strongly there in the New Testament. The idea that people should, as far as possible, support themselves, that's very strongly there in the New Testament. So, I mean, a lot of the themes are repeated. It's just that I didn't want to go on all night.
Thank you for your talk, Tom. I want to ask you about methodology. So it was helpful to sort of set out that methodology, as you indicated that it can be sort of too hasty jump to
yeah.
from the Bible to contemporary notions. I was wondering to what extent some of these principles you drew out, is it best to describe them as principles? Perhaps it is, or are they in some way embedded in narratives that are more basic? Maybe that's just a fashion in recent years to talk about narrative over principle. But maybe sometimes there just are principles that don't necessarily come as a feature of a larger narrative of salvation for Israel or something like that. I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Okay, right. The answer is... Quite a lot of the points which I was making do then emerge in the narrative. So, for example, the whole issue about who has land, Naboth's vineyard is a very good example of that. And these do crop up through the Old Testament. So, maybe it's just the way I think about these things. Because I want to draw out things which I feel can carry weight, as it were, into the current situation. Somehow, what I want to do is to abstract from the particular cultural and so on. So, I mean, rather grandly, what I'm trying to do is to ask, well, what's in God's mind with, you know, you've got all this material of the law in the Old Testament. Why? You know, what's in God's mind here? What's he thinking about? So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say, can we see through this material to something which we can actually use? Because if we can't, then frankly, I'm not quite sure why we have the Old Testament, or at least why we have these passages in the Old Testament. You know, you can have others about sacrificial system or something like that. You can see how that immediately carries through into the New Testament. This material is pretty strange, actually. Now, what's the great narrative? Well, the great narrative, I think, is God's people, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, are meant to be a light to the world as to how people, God wants people actually to live their lives in community. And that becomes the prototype for the redeemed community at the eschaton. So that's the way I would fit it together. And I think what God is doing is he's not kind of letting us adrift in a fallen world. He's actually saying, look, this is the way I want my people to behave. This is the way I want them to organize their lives. And if you can, you know, if you follow the way I'm doing it, then you can begin to pull stuff out. Now, I am aware that there are Old Testament scholars who would say you cannot divorce this material from the context. To which I think I'd want to say they need to read some sociology, actually. Because it seems to me modern social science does effectively go behind narratives, stories, and so on to say, this is the reality that lies behind that. And you don't have to be a Marxist to do that. Does that kind of answer your question?
No, so I guess you would see these principles maybe as an aspect of the witness of God's people to the nations,
yes.
whether that's
yes.
Israel or the church,
yeah.
and a witness, I suppose, to God's ways of and desires for I guess, redeemed life together.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I mean, it's clear that ancient Israel was meant to be a light to the Gentiles. I mean, that's what it was there for. You know? That's right, going right back to Abraham. That's what they're supposed to be doing. So I do think they're a paradigm, they're a kind of illustration as to how God's people can live together, and like that can always shine out to the nations and say, look, you don't have to live in this way. There's a better way of doing it.
That's helpful, thanks.
Sorry for your name. Was it David?
David, yeah. Thank you. Just so with this in mind, I wonder in terms of the question of ethical banking.
Right.
And the question is as broad as that, really. or more specifically, should we say, should the church, whatever the church looks like, or however you want to define that, be actually looking at moving into the banking sector rather than propping up a sector?
Well, again, very big topic.
Yeah, I apologize for the breadth of it.
Right, I mean, I think one of the issues which as Christians, we really need to think about is obviously in a modern capitalist economy, you have to save in various kinds of ways. So most people will be saving for their pension, for example. So a saving structure is important. And some of that you control and some of it you don't control. What I find unsettling about the way in which financial markets work is that if I put money into any one of the mainstream banks, I have absolutely no idea what that money is being used to finance. I have no idea at all. What's more, I can't find out. Okay? Now, there are ethical banks around. So there's a bank called the Triodos Bank, which actually has a very, very strict ethical policy. It doesn't, unfortunately, run current accounts currently.
It doesn't.
Sorry?
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't, unfortunately. But if you've got money which you want to invest ethically, that's a really good route. There are other ethical funds which, on the whole, are pretty transparent. The one which my wife and I put quite a lot of money into is the one called the Stewardship Trust, where they have an ethical council of reference. And until very recently, the chair of the ethical council of reference was the Archbishop of Canterbury. So, and they took ethical issues really seriously. What I quite liked about them was that if some company kind of drifted away, they didn't immediately sell out. What they would do is they would send a number of people in to talk to the company and say, you know, why are you drifting away from, why are you doing this, which looks unethical? And so they would engage with them, and if they wouldn't change their ways, then they would pull the investment out. But we have a serious problem that it's quite difficult in financial markets to behave ethically as a saver, because you don't know how your money's being used. I mean, it was only about 10 years ago or so that the main university pension scheme for academics actually issued a complete listing of everything that it invested in. And there were some fairly red faces for some of the things which it was involved with. And I'm glad to say that on the whole they cleaned up their act quite quickly after that. But certainly in my own college we had quite lively discussions on the governing body as to what sorts of things an Oxford College should invest in or should not invest in. I lost every time, but there we are. Is that?
Yeah, no, that's thank you.
Donald, thanks for a really great talk. I guess I just wanted to ask you about three points that you made. The first one was about when you mentioned creating a living wage or a minimum wage.
Yeah, sure.
Which I agree with you. But I guess I wanted to ask maybe how you would respond to a conservative economist who might say, well, you know, if you divorce the wage from, say, marginal product of labour, you create distortions, you might increase unemployment, that kind of general argument. The second point was on
Can I answer them one at a time?
Yes, sure.
Because I find it pretty, otherwise I tend to forget them.
Sure.
The answer on that is that there does seem to be something of an efficiency wage story going on here.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence is that raising the minimum wage has not created unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's had efficiency wage incentives that actually the productivity of people who are paid a decent wage actually goes up.
Yeah.
So the evidence is not in favour of the conservative economists at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the other part of it is, you know, the question then is, well, if companies had to pay more under a living wage thing to operate in London, they might very well decide to move their operations outside London.
Yeah.
And what's happening at the moment is, because they're really pressed, because they've got lots of other costs, they tend to squeeze their workers.
Sure.
And you could find quite a lot of relocation going on.
Which comes back to your point about being local.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the second point was on how you advocated education, which I also think is excellent. I just wondered about what you might think about, you know, societies that are given every opportunity to become educated, but then because of technological change or structural transition in the economy, people still lose their jobs. What kind of framework would we allow them to deal with that?
I think the point I was trying to make is that in the Old Testament economy, the only piece of real capital was land, except it wasn't capital, it was land,
sure.
And the only kind of asset. Whereas in the modern economy, the main asset that people work with is human capital. And because they operate with human capital, what we need to do is to ensure that human capital is built up, and also that it's in other words, I think there's a lot said now about kind of ongoing training and education and so on.
Sure.
So I don't think it should stop at 18 or 21.
Yeah.
It should be something that goes on. And companies need to think much harder about the kind of training that they give to their workers.
Mm.
Not so much in terms of just how to operate this machine or whatever it is, but actually ensuring that they're developing general skills which could be used elsewhere. So that's the way I would go on that.
Mm. And then the final question was just on the notion of loans and debt forgiveness, and I just wondered about how you might deal with the incentive incompatible notion of I might not even borrow if I know that he may not pay me back for 7 years.
Well, I think the thing is, I'm not at all convinced that actually what we have in the Old Testament looks anything like a working capital market.
Yeah.
Actually, what's going on is mutual insurance. I think that's the best way to interpret it, because if you look at the detailed the detailed material which underlies it, it's clear this is talking about a situation where, you know, 1 year you're in a bad way, so I help out you and your family, the next year you do okay, and then you help, but I don't, so you help me out. And so the whole business about zero interest and so on is simply, I think, because in a sense you're creating some kind of mutual reciprocity within the society, and says that's a better way of handling this. And then if people, you know, if their crops fail several times in a row, they will build up a debt, but it's not to be seen as a debt because it's actually going to be got rid of at the end of 7 years. So it's it's a kind of relational finance. That I prefer to actually see it as a mutual insurance system, which is not the way all the arguments about usury and so on have gone.
Sure. And when I guess you consider, like you mentioned, that we have a big debt problem, how would we kind of rectify that, I guess, from Christian principles,
well,
when the debt's very large and they're not just between friends or brothers,
No, but between nations? I think, well, I am quite kind of radical on this. I think we should stop lending money to people for consumption purposes. I think we should have loan systems for buying kind of real assets. So I've got no concerns about lending for housing and so on. So long as you're not doing what they did in the States, which was to lend lots of money to people who had no hope of paying one, which was utterly evil, actually. So, I mean, I'm old enough to remember my father saying to me in the 1950s that he actually regarded being in debt as sinful. Now, you can't imagine anybody saying that now. And I have to say that quite a, you know, My general reaction to that as I grew a bit older was, you know, poor old chap, you know. but maybe he's got a point.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe if we had an economy which wasn't based on consumer debt in the way in which ours is now, it would be a much sounder economy. I mean, it would be a very painful transition. But I would... You know, if we set ourselves a 25-year time horizon to phase out consumer debt, that would be quite an interesting move. But it might lead, I think, to a much sounder economy. And the thing which really frightens me at the moment is that, you know, we get all these triumphant things about the UK economy, it's reviving and all the rest of it. And you say, well, what's reviving it? And the answer is consumer debt's going up.
Mm-hmm.
You just say to yourself, well, that can't last. Because, you know, it accumulates and there will be serious problems. So I fully expect another consumer debt crisis in the life of the next parliament.
Mm.
I could be wrong. I'm an economist, after all.
Thank you.
Mm.
Any other questions? We'll do Kim and then Story.
Hi.
Hi.
You seem quite passionate about the inheritance tax, but so in the Old Testament I can see like people pass down the wealth to their kids and children, and I'm just wondering.
The only thing they passed down was their land, actually.
Yeah.
And they weren't allowed to accumulate land.
What do you mean by not allowed to accumulate?
Well, because at the Jubilee the land had to go back, so. If this was your family's inheritance in the land, that was it. You might get control of other land because somebody else fell into debt and so on, but it was like you took a lease on it. Okay, so there weren't the kind of asset bases unless you were Solomon, and he accumulated lots and lots of gold, as far as we can make out. So. I mean, I was trying to think through the inheritance thing. Partly because it seemed to be one of the kind of the beauties of the Israelite economy was that everybody, in a sense, started off on the same basis. And every so often you kind of put that back. Maybe inheritance tax isn't the right way of doing it, but it just seems to a good suggestion. And I think particularly if it were linked, and the whole idea of the Jubilee was that it kind of spread the assets out again. So what I'm looking for is some way of spreading the assets out again. And maybe an inheritance tax, particularly if it was linked to a sovereign wealth fund, or many sovereign wealth better, that could actually do the kind of spreading out again, because it would mean that as the sovereign wealth funds built up, they would be able to actually spread wealth more widely. It's a thought, anyway.
Leslie, you had a second question.
Something else going in front of me.
That was Kim, who just went.
The problem lies in the execution. I'm so fascinated with what you've told us and the way you've unpacked this. And I'm sort of carried along with it and feel wholly with you in it. It's just but how you implemented and how much it was, they managed to implement it then. I mean, with the Jubilee,
right.
Of course,
yeah.
it never happened, apparently. So is this just a lovely dream, which, and how do we, it seems to me, it's what we have to keep in mind as a sort of in our thinking, and how we get that into the thinking of people, of justice, and so on. We somehow need to find a way of expressing it, to express it in the country. Well, when we get it okay from the Bible, that's where it's coming from, but with a society that's lost the Bible, we have to somehow go for it in terms which the society can grasp and implement.
Well, I think I think I've got a number of things to say. we take those principles of economic justice. I think it would be possible to argue for those in purely, like, functional terms. Societies would work much better if this were true. You wouldn't find many people who would say, that's nonsense. Maybe they wouldn't like the last one. But actually, much of this is sort of kind of out there. So I suppose my view is, I believe in some sort of common grace, some kind of model of common grace, so that I think that if you put into the public domain things which are evidently true, because they're the way God has actually made us to live in community, even those who are not believers will be able to kind of understand and pick up on those things. So that's one side. Now, the other part of it, of course, is that we live in a very fallen world, and that some cultures are much more inimical to this sort of thing than others are. And I think all the Christians can do in that situation is what I call, we go for as much as we can, given the situation. I always think when Jesus was asked about divorce, and his interlocutors said to him, but Moses permitted divorce. Jesus says, it's for your hardness of heart. What I think we need to do is we need to, as it were, examine the question, how far can we go given the hardness of heart of our society? And it may be that we can't go anywhere. You know, if I was a Christian living in Saudi Arabia at the moment, there's nothing I can do. It's much harder for Christians in this country to do it now than it was, say, at the time of William Temple when he was Archbishop of Canterbury. Because that was a time when people actually listened to the church and what the church had to say. So I think you just have to be kind of, you have to be wise as serpent, actually. So you have to think, what can I do? How far can I get? And sometimes it may not be very far at all. Has that even begun to scratch the question?
Well, yes, certainly. I'm very grateful for that, and I figure just in practical terms, from what you were saying about Saudi Arabia, my son-in-law happens to be an employer in the Emirates.
All right.
And employs 90,000 people there. He was taken out there 7 years ago to run the airports there.
All right.
And the first thing he did was on the first pay round was he said, well, what I'm going to do this year is I'm going to double the pay of all the, what those at the bottom, who are the Indian workers, who have been. And nobody at the top is going to get an increase, who have all the people for whom in Dubai, I think, as perhaps here too.
Right. I mean, almost certainly it was a highly successful move, because I'm pretty sure that all those people at the lowest level actually started to work much harder.
You're absolutely right. I mean, the whole airport ethos in the airport
changed.
Snapped, you know, and it's gone roaring ahead.
I think Christians just have to be kind of a bit bold. They don't necessarily have to shout, this is a Christian thing.
No, wouldn't suggest that.
You know, you couldn't do it in Dubai, presumably. But you do need to kind of have this at the back of your mind.
Mm.
My own experience in running a large part of the university was that actually Christian principles were extremely valuable in trying to kind of sort out what was going on and to understand why people were behaving the way in which they did. I mean, not that I ever kind of waved a Christian stick at anybody. One of the most remarkable things that happened was that, at least it impressed me enormously, was that soon after I'd taken over the social sciences division, there was a problem arose about the examining conventions for philosophy, politics and economics, which were always very complicated. And the conventions had reached, I can't remember, 16 pages or something, and they were so complex that there'd been a real issue the previous year as to exactly what they meant. So I called up somebody I knew who had been a very faithful servant of the university, an academic, very faithful servant, who I knew was kind of exercised about these conventions. And I said, would you mind, you know, sitting down and just trying to sort them out for us? So, a little reluctantly, he said, yes, I will. And he came back, I don't know, a couple of months later, and he produced 16 pages to 5 of these conventions. And what's more, he pointed out that there were a large number of inconsistencies in what had been done before, and that's why they'd be having all these problems. Anyway, he sent this to me, and I did what I thought was a very simple thing. I sent him an email saying, thank you so much for doing such a wonderful job. Within half an hour, I had an email back from this guy saying, this is the first time anybody in this university has ever thanked me for doing anything. And I thought, that's incredible. So one of the things which I always did from that point on, I hope I would have always done it, but I always did it, I always thanked people if they did a really good job. And it was amazing how people responded to that. Now that's a very simple, I actually think that's a matter of justice in some ways. At a very simple level, it's a matter of justice. You treat the other human being not as your slave, not as your, not as someone who is kind of, you're going to use to do this task, but someone who's a human being who's made an effort to do something and do it really well. And they deserve thanks. But I just couldn't believe it when he said, this is the first time, and he'd been around the university, he'd done a lot of things at the university for at least 30 years, if not longer. This is the first time I've ever been thanked. So there we are. So you can make big differences in very simple ways.
Do you have a question? I saw your hand move.
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Donald. Okay.